Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 736. This episode brought I'm on tour this weekend. I'm doing the Tonight Show tomorrow.
What?
Tomorrow Thursday I'm doing the Tonight Show, and then Friday in Buffalo, Saturday in Toronto. And then for Just for Laughs.
Oh, fun.
And then more dates. Doing more dates, Los Angeles, I'm doing, Salt Lake City.
Oh, what are you going to do in L.A.?
At the Regent.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's a great theater.
I know. I saw Churches there, I think.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
I saw,
that's next to the Orpheum, right? Regent's next to the Orpheum?
It's right next to it. I saw Stuff You Should Know Live there.
It's a really cool... Oh, that's awesome that they did that there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool venue. It's a cool little venue. So I'm doing two shows there in October. And Boise, you know, is another city. So, yeah, fun, comfortable tour. April Richardson's going to be on the road with me.
AP.
Shooting the special in January.
Oh, nice.
So I'm going to be doing some club dates ramping up to that. In January, I'll do, like, you know, five shows at the Comedy Attic in Bloomington. And then
I'm doing
Zay's
mine in
December,
so I'm in the mad dash.
Oh, you are? That's awesome.
Yep. I'm doing Meltdown December 4th.
Do you have a title for yours yet?
It's going to be called I'm a Person.
Oh, yeah, I think maybe you told me that before.
You're not a person, you're a Muppet.
That's you're the opening
Muppet.
Bit in the album, so it'll be fun. Walk around Muppet comes up.
Did you watch the Muppet Show?
I have not yet. I'm excited for the advertised full frontal nudity.
It's really interesting because the character, you'll see it.
How does it rank against Muppets Tonight, which I liked a lot?
Well, it's just different. It's more the Office style. It's more not
quite the joke machine
documentary style. There's actually like a little bit of drama in it too. There's like a little bit of drama. And Kermit, who always was sort of an incurable optimist,
mm-hmm.
he's a little neurotic in this one, so it's kind of interesting.
So it's kind of a Muppets Take Manhattan kind of
maybe
feel
a little
there.
Bit more, yeah, maybe a
that
little
movie
bit
is a little more depressing than you remember when you watch it sometimes.
But you love watching Rizzo the Rat skate across a grill.
Oh,
so.
Man, what a delicious diner.
But what do you have on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
I have one that I'm really excited about. Ty Rodriguez is an artist who I've worked with in the past before, and he is now doing animated sequences for Children's Hunger Fund.
Nice.
They have a YouTube channel where they have actual like animated sequences explaining both situations in different countries and then how you can help.
Well, why would they want to raise money to help children be hungry?
No, they're helping kids.
Oh, gotcha.
They're
all right.
Eat so more butter.
They're trying to get rid of hunger.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a much better plan.
Oh, yeah. No, it's I mean,
than the way you made it sound.
Are you, in fact, donating to a charity that's trying to make kids hungry?
No, that would be – that's not the charity that you
imagine like a charlatan.
You want to stop hunger. You want to stop world hunger.
Chris,
no.
Give us a check. We want to make those kids so hungry.
Where can people go?
Go to their YouTube channel, which is Children's Hunger Fund. And then you go through and they have all these sequences that then lead you to different places to do stuff. It's a really great kind of educational but also super entertaining system. And my buddy Ty Rodriguez does the animation for them.
Fantastic. Katie Levine, what you got?
I want to remind people that Nerdist has a team at this year's Strut Your Mutt, which is put on by Best Friends Animal Society. It is a dog-themed festival with a 5K run and a walk, and all the proceeds go to shelter animals. They have events all over the country, but in LA, we created the Team Nerdist, and you can either join
Lisa
the Team
and I
Nerdist.
Are going.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can either join Team Nerdist or you can donate to help us meet our fundraising goal by going to nerdi.st/mutt. And I just want to thank a few people who have joined or donated, including Nikki Malmesbury.
What up, Nikki Malmesbury?
Diana Galloway, Hugh Hunter, Carlos Gonzalez, Rob Rudolph, and more.
Is your dog the mother of dragons?
Yes.
Good.
We only give her stuffed dragons, so she's always walking around with a little dragon
so
hanging out of her mouth.
Are
it's
she
the
and
cutest
Scout going to meet?
That could be.
Scout and I will be there.
I'm afraid that she's going to be real high energy and bum Scout out.
No, Scout will love it.
Just get some life into Scout. Like
Scout plays.
Because my dog is the anti-Scout. My dog, we actually have to start feeding her more because she does so much cardio, like just running around every day that she like can't keep weight on. It's insane.
Oh, wow.
She just literally almost vertically just runs around our yard.
Well, maybe they'll balance each other out.
Yeah.
This episode of the show is Rob Lowe, who was fucking rad.
And handsome.
Of course he's handsome. We knew that about him, but he's such a... I've always heard what a good guy he is, and he is a top shelf dude. He's promoting The Grinder, which premieres Tuesday, September 29th at 8:30 p.m. on Fox, and you should watch it and worship him.
Rob, make him our new god.
Let's make Rob Lowe our new god. Lowe is the new high.
Lowe is the new on high.
Yeah, okay, that's better. Thank you. That was a good adjustment. This with Rob Lowe. Katie! Rah, rah, rah.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Show today. as a like a joke. A joke, a brag joke. All right, a fucking humble brag joke.
What is your humble, what's in it? Well, I missed what's in it. Your Nobel Peace Prize?
My Nobel Peace Prize.
What's in it?
Yeah, my Nobel Peace Prize and Mother Teresa's heart.
Yes, good.
Which I carry around in a box.
As you should.
How are you?
I'm good, man.
It's so nice to see you.
It's good to be here.
You'd never remember this. We met so many years ago.
Where?
Literally so many years ago. I worked at Bel Air Country Club in college, and you were there. I feel like you were playing golf with Peter Scolari.
Yes, I was.
Okay.
By the way, that may have been the day I got married.
Was that? I think that was the day you got married.
I'm pretty sure that was the day. I know I played Bel Air Country Club with Peter, and I only played with – yeah, it was the day I got married, for sure.
I was working in the golf shop. I was in college. I was working in the golf shop, and he was like, oh, this is Rob, and – And I think you said, yeah, I just got married.
That's amazing. See, so you brought me good luck. I'm still married.
I hope. Yeah. Yes. I'm sure that had nothing
it was you.
To do with you guys. And it was just all my juxtaposition to the date that you guys
it
got
was
married.
All you. Excellent.
Oh, God. I just got engaged. Give me some advice. Did you have a super fancy wedding? Or
my advice is play golf with Peter Scolari. Come on. No, I think it's enough pressure to get married as it is, at least it was for me, that I didn't want the added pressure of like who's going to sit where and
right.
down payments and ballrooms and all that crap. I hated it.
Yeah.
Hated it. So we did it really casually at a friend's house and you know, secretively nobody even knew we were doing it. And it was so great. It's one of my favorite memories I had because we just didn't get caught up in the hype.
Yeah. And also, that was at a time where there was no social media. So it wasn't like, we got to share all the pictures.
Yes.
Someone's going to do the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there was still, we were still a pretty tabloidy culture back then.
Oh, completely. Well, we had to go through all kinds of protocol to make sure nobody, that it didn't get out. And because we wanted it to be private. And we did. You know, you can do it if there's a will, there's a way.
Right.
You can do it.
I kind of feel like most of the people that complain about paparazzi and not getting private lives, they kind of invite some of
There's
that
no
stuff.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, first of all, if they complain about it and they live in Los Angeles, then they need to shut the fuck up.
If you're going to the Grove.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, really, get a life. Come on.
If you're going to the Grove and complaining loudly, why won't these paparazzi? I say, why won't these yes. paparazzi? Yes. Let me live.
Oh, wait, I'm backlit. Wait, it's a much better angle here. I'm so sorry.
Let me live in front of this fountain,
making
which is a
my
much
life
better background.
Miserable.
If I'm being honest.
I'm an artist. I shouldn't be bothered.
It's a better background than the movie theater.
Yuck.
Let's be honest. How have you avoided all of that? So when you first started, you got successful right away. Wasn't your first job you were nominated for a Golden Globe? right out of the gate.
I think you're right. My first big – look, I was acting since I was 8, but then I came to Hollywood and my first movie was The Outsiders. And then the very next thing I did was a TV movie where I was nominated for a Golden Globe, and I think I was 18.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, The Outsiders – someone just posted on Reddit not that long ago. There's a subreddit called Old School Cool, and it's just like old school pictures where everyone just looks rad. And it's all throughout the history of photography. And someone put an Outsiders picture up, and it's just you guys all in the back of the truck.
The truck shot, yeah, I know that one.
And it's so stunning what a hotbed of influence.
That truck was not only a flatbed, it was a hotbed.
It was a flat hotbed. It was a flat hotbed for all the fan fiction.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, did you guys have any... Could you even what was your experience at the time? Did you even understand what you were doing? Or like, yeah, we're just working. Who knows who these guys are or whatever.
I mean, I wrote a little bit about this in my first book. The process for auditioning was so arduous and so insane and full of the creme de la creme of actors in that age group. That if you made it, there was a sense that definitely this was the group for sure.
Right.
I mean, we did sort of have that feeling. And listen, Coppola was and is one of the greats of all time. So we also knew that this movie could be big and probably would be, but I don't think any of us thought that, you know, I didn't think I'd be, you know, here so many years later, still necessarily doing it. You know, you just never know.
I mean, I just think about what I was like when I was 17, 18 years old and there was not really a lot of foresight into anything. No. It was just like, where am I supposed to go? Okay, I'll just go here.
Yeah, no, we were an odd group in that way, and I see it reflected to me through the mirror of my own sons who are just passing through that age,
right?
And I look at them and I go, wait a minute. Okay, so I was that age when I was on location with Francis Coppola and The Outsiders, and we were just all so focused and so ambitious and so on it. And like, my kids are like, you know, can barely figure out how to, like, you know, put the toilet seat down.
But I think it's a rare gift when you know what you want to do when you're young. I think, yes, it's a weird, because I think if you ask most people, they don't even know what they want. They don't even know what they want. Well, I don't know what I want to do. I don't know. I just want more of something. I don't even know what that is. But you, did you always, I mean, did you fervently pursue that? Or did someone go, hey, you got a good look. You should be in the pictures.
No, I always wanted to do it. And I do think it's a gift. I really do. I have such empathy for people of all ages who struggle with what their mission in life is. I really, really do. Because it's just, many of things I've had to figure out in my own life that were not fun, but that was not one of them.
Right.
And so knowing that, you just focus and you do it and you make it happen. And I had it in my head when I was eight years old in Dayton, Ohio, that I wanted to be. It was the ignorance. What is it? Ignorance is bliss.
Of course.
I was like, yeah, sure. Living in Dayton, Ohio, movie star, actor, TV. Absolutely. Sure. They just roll them out from Dayton, Ohio. It's a hotbed of,
you know, it's a hot and a flatbed, yeah, exactly, of activity. But it's almost, you know, in that case, ignorance can also be an asset because.
Yes, no, for sure.
Because if your head is filled with too many rules, you would go, oh, well, I can't. Why would I? Particularly then, you know, yes, where there was media was basically just a few companies and only a couple of platforms, and it was much harder to squeeze through that little funnel.
Oh, and also the entertainment business was not a youth business then.
Right.
I mean, that's the really the most amazing thing.
Movies like Outsiders changed that, though.
It's a little bit of being at the right place at the right time, and also helping in you know, my own small, humble way, along with many others, of changing the business into what it is today, almost to its detriment. But you know, when I came up, the concept that every good-looking high school kid would have a Screen Actors Guild card was just sort of like unbelievable. And then today, that's what it is.
I know everyone's famous in the sense that, you know, you can broadcast your life, and there's no, you know, the good side of that is a lot of people can be discovered that wouldn't have normally been discovered,
yep,
through what is sometimes a very oppressive, exclusionary system. But yep, then, of course, you know, sometimes it feels like, oh, I don't know, is it special anymore? Like, is it really special to be able to do it when everyone can do it? Is it, you know, is it still special?
Well, I think the vetting process for fame was an actual vetting process. And today it isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a yawning cat can be famous.
They're so cute, though.
Right? They are.
Rob,
it's true. I don't want to run down yawning cats. I don't. They're
hey, Rob
great.
Lowe, I own some yawning cats, and I really did not appreciate your recent appearance on the podcast.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I was actually quite offended. Yes. You know, these cats have a problem.
That's right.
We're capitalizing on it, but you should respect it.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, that period, it's still so fascinating to me to have a leg on both sides of what media and pop culture was, that I still remember a time where you didn't know everything about everyone. And
yeah,
it was, there was still a bit of mystery behind people, and you just got little glimpses. I mean, obviously, I assume it was easier to control back then.
Listen, just imagine this. Pick who's your most famous, iconic star of old? Who'd it be?
How old?
Is it Clark Gable? Is it Steve McQueen? Is it?
Oh, you know, it's probably a bogey or
okay,
a
bogey. Okay, picture video of Bogey walking out of a Starbucks.
Picture away from me, please.
Picture Bogey with his like yoga mat.
Yeah,
getting into his Prius.
Yeah, I've seen some pictures of Bogey. I don't think exercise was
he wouldn't be Bogey anymore.
No,
he'd just be another actor getting into his Prius.
Yeah, it's so funny to think that how the conversation changed from film to television, where it's like, you know, television got a little bit closer to people because it put entertainment directly in their homes, right, and they were like a foot from it, you know? So that separation of, oh, that's this weird ethereal thing that's untouchable, and mm-hmm. making it, oh, well, maybe this is something that's a little more achievable.
Yeah, no, and I have a lot of theories about this, having worked and continuing to work in both mediums, and the way that people relate to it is so different. But also in a theater, you're literally looking up to the actor.
Sure. Psychologically, and they're enormous,
mm-hmm.
so that they feel bigger than you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're on TV, you know, people – they're very comfortable. They'll come up and say, you know.
I remember when I was doing tons and tons of movies, and Michael J. Fox was the biggest thing on television. He and I were in a car together. We pulled up at a light. And the difference in the way that people related to him and the difference in the way they related to me, it was unbelievable. I mean, you know, with Mike, like, hey, man, what are you doing? Like they knew him. Like he was a friend. Like. And they were so intimate with him immediately that it was my first sort of lesson in the intimacy of TV.
Well, and to you, you were a film guy, so they were very much like,
yeah.
Oh, that's Robbie.
Yeah, it was a very whispery and kind of side glancing and, you know, that kind of stuff.
I know, but that's when you need to – that's when you have the opportunity to really freak them out and be like, who dares step near my vehicle? Yeah. You know, like, yeah, booming,
yeah,
voice.
Yeah.
Freak them out.
I have people that do that for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, now, yeah, now. Yeah. Was the whole thing that I'm sure you're probably sick of talking about, the Brat Pack thing, was that just – they just put that on you guys, right? That wasn't anything that you – Did when you were doing these this sort of like this stratum of films,
yeah,
and these different types of movies that involved, you know, John Hughes and all these different all the other characters that were involved, that was just a reality show that the press was making up, right?
Well, it was honestly, and I don't blame them. It was a catch-all phrase to just. It was just easier than trying to figure out who was doing what movie and what director.
Right.
They were just like, ah, the Brat Pack. So yeah, it was a media created name that we hated at the time.
I can imagine.
Because it was sort of, you know, generalizing and debasing and nonspecific and had a sort of whiff of pejorative to it that we were somehow more interested in being famous or – I don't know. I don't know what – I could never really put my finger on it, but you could tell that it wasn't meant as a compliment.
Right. It was sort of I think – I didn't read it this way when I was a kid because, of course, I looked up to all you
guys.
Well,
wait. That's the point. Here's what I've learned. That the people who matter would have been you as a kid.
Sure.
They never got the artsy, fartsy, elite, like entertainment press dog whistle.
Right.
They didn't hear it. They're like, Brat Pack, love these people.
Yeah.
And what's great about that is I now embrace the Brat Pack because of it, because I realized that the snark was completely lost on the people who they were trying to reach.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, although, you know, when I was growing up, of course, I wanted to be more of a Rob Lowe, but I was actually more of an Anthony Michael Hall, just in terms
of... You were.
Oh, my God. I mean, without a doubt. Just the, you know, the nerdy, awkward kid,
yeah,
who tried to be cool and make jokes, right. and usually put my foot in my mouth. Although, Anthony Michael Hall, it's so funny to see him
his performance in Breakfast...
Stunning. Yeah.
By the way, the Breakfast Club today... if it came out, would be nominated for Best Picture of the Year.
Yeah.
Without a question.
Yeah.
That's another way that the industry has changed. First of all, it would come out today. It would either be – if it had good actors in it, it would be made for nothing independently, or it would be made by a studio with shitty actors in it.
Yeah.
And no, for sure. And the good version would be nominated for Best Picture, but in the day when it came out – it was still – those movies were still ghettoized. They were still like sitting at the kids' table of the industry. Like Terms of Endearment was a movie.
Right, because –
The Breakfast Club was some, you know, like teen thing they threw out there. Meanwhile, when you look at it today, it's amazing.
Well, of course it was because, you know, there were a handful of movies that for the first time actually spoke very honestly to what it felt like to be – like, you know, Fast Times being one of the first movies that really said, no, this is what high school is actually like.
Mm-hmm.
These are the social dynamics that are in high school. And then, you know, when John Hughes came along and really hit upon that slice of teenage Americana, and Breakfast Club being – such an honest and poetic portrayal of teen angst and how we're not all perfect and we're more than what we seem on the surface, and these people came together just as human beings because they were all outcast in some way. Like, that such a gorgeous story.
It's a beautiful movie. I mean, I wish I'd have been in it. It's my, I think that there's that movie and then there's just everything else, you know, in that era.
Was there an opportunity for you to be in it?
I met John to play the role that Judd Nelson ended up playing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The bad boy?
The bad boy.
With the long hair and the earring?
Yeah.
And
I just remember, the only thing I remember about it is in the script, he wore a cowboy hat. That's the only thing I remember. And somebody wisely, obviously, ixnayed the cowboy hat. Probably Judd.
You didn't show up to the audition to the meeting with the cowboy hat, did you?
Even I knew that was a bad idea.
Okay, good. You know, I never know.
John Hughes can't be right about everything.
He's not, no. But he was right about a lot of stuff.
He was right about a lot.
But he was not right about that. Yeah. I can't, I almost think it'd be kind of funny if you were able to, you just go back and shoot scenes from stuff you wanted to be in.
Oh, how great would that be?
Like, you know, I really wanted to be in this, and I'm just going to assemble. Like, you could assemble Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall and Emilio Estevez. You could get all those people together and be like, listen, you know, Judd, I'm really sorry. I really just, this was meant a lot to me. Can I just be this guy just for one scene?
It's kind of a good idea. I could do that with a number of things.
I mean, it's, you know, what's amazing is whenever you meet people who survive a phase, like a trend,
yeah,
you know, because I know to you guys it doesn't seem like a trend, but it was definitely, that's how the press was portraying it. And so to survive that, even to survive the 80s, was kind of a big deal. How are you able to do that?
You know, I have two thoughts. One is the press did think it was a trend, and what they missed was it was the beginning of the new normal.
Right.
I mean, that's what our industry is now. It's totally catered to, you know, 15 to 25 year olds.
Yeah, the most coveted demographic now.
Yeah, exactly. And so is the storytelling. So the roles have switched. When I came up, the kids were supporting the adults who were the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And now the adults are supporting the kids who are the stars.
Right.
That's neither good nor bad. It just is what it is. And, but you know, my theory on fallow periods, you know, in careers is that's the good news, because you have to be around long enough to have ups and downs.
Sure.
Right. And Everybody has them. Even the people you think, wow, they're untouchable. You know, I remember when Tiger Woods won everything, and now, you know, he's struggling. Or when Tom Cruise was the master of all, he surveyed, and then, you know, he struggled, and now he's back with a vengeance, as he should be.
Right.
Michael Douglas, all my heroes have go through that moment where it's just, you know, which is not working. Clayton Kershaw, the Dodgers, has it. Everybody has it.
So do you think,
you know who doesn't have it?
Who?
One hit wonders.
No, they don't. They don't have it. They get the one time.
Nope.
And then that's it.
Yep.
But that's not bad. I mean, you know, like, I don't think it's terrible to be a one hit wonder. You still get some of it. But then, you know, there's a lot of responsibility to be on top for a long time, I would imagine.
Yeah. Listen. I mean, that is the goal at the end of the day, was just to be relevant and, you know, be a part of the conversation and have something to say, you know, decade in and decade out.
But you obviously had some awareness about yourself with the choices that you were. I mean, like, to take Wayne's World was such a genius, because not only, again, beginning of a new decade, mm-hmm. and it introduced you to a whole new group of people, and people who did know you, who thought, oh, that's a serious romantic lead, Rob Lowe. And then all of a sudden you're really funny in a movie that completely changed the way that comedy films are made.
Yeah.
And you're a part of that, and you're obviously, you're playing the role that, you know, that a movie like that, if it were serious, would have cast you in. It's like, I'm the handsome, serious
yes.
guy who's going to fuck up everything in your life. But you played with that. So, you know, did you acquire that? Like, how did you even think that was something you should do?
It's funny. I think... Yes. Okay, Wayne's World happened at a time where I had just gotten sober.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm now sober 25 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very nice. Get away from my vehicle.
And I think as part of that for me was a sort of letting go of a lot of stuff. And one of the things I let go of was what people thought about me. You know, trying to people please.
Yeah.
All of that stuff. And I just began to sort of follow it sounds really awful to say, but sort of follow my heart. Sounds so corny. And do the sort of footwork and get out of the results. So right. In other words, enjoy the process, do it for the process, and let the chips fall where they may, as opposed to going, well, if I do this, it'll lead to that. And I think that this appeals more to that. All that bullshit, I just didn't do it anymore. And I think the minute I started doing that, it opened totally new arenas for me creatively. And Wayne's World was the first movie I think that I did with that mindset.
And then that was a whole new – I mean, because it's – you know, what's so interesting is that you've been through so much and you've had so many different types of careers and, you know, you've had scandals and dips and high points and but you've – every time you always manage to kind of just get up and dust off and wipe the dirt out of your eyes and be like, okay, what's next? And I think there is something in that, there is a valuable lesson for anyone who thinks, oh no, something's happened and my life is over, or something has been going on and – I'm in a period, and how am I ever going to get out? And so, you know, is it really what you just said about, I'm just going to start embracing this, you know, these things that make me happy? I mean, how do you, what advice do you give to people to get up and dust themselves off and move forward?
The main thing for me is I if something bad happens, right, my first instinct is, what can I do about it? What can I do better? What can I not do the next time? And I genuinely believe that it's a way forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but I see a lot of people whose first instinct is, I'm a victim. Society or others fucked me.
Mm-hmm.
And poor me. And that's just not me. I mean, even when I have been fucked over, I don't go there. I don't go to the victim place. And unfortunately, I think you see that so much in our culture.
Yeah.
Like that everybody's oppressed. Everybody's put upon. Everybody's got people standing in their way. And it's just bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly, the thing that I try to say to people when they ask, like, oh, how do I, you know, I really want to achieve all this stuff. What do I do? And I go, look, you... With exceptions, there are things that you cannot control. There, you know, things can happen, accidents can happen, people can get ill. I mean, there are things that are not in your control.
Yes.
But a percentage of your life is a direct result of the choices that you make.
Yes.
A direct result. And if you – and it's very hard to realize that, because it's very hard to take responsibility for your shit. But if you just made better choices, and even what you just did, you asked like four really good questions. What can I do to make – instead of going – why has this always happened to me?
Exactly.
Because your brain will answer, oh, well, you're a piece of shit. You know what I mean? If you go, well, what can I learn from this? Then your brain will give you those answers. Oh, well, don't do this. Don't do this. Here's how to move forward. Ask yourself better questions and look at your life and really see what you can change for the better.
That's exactly – you know, you have to look to yourself. Everybody – the people who look to others are inevitably going to be unsatisfied.
Yeah. And also – it's important to know what it is that you want so you know how to make yourself happy. Because if other people are determining what makes you happy, you're putting a lot of your ego into the external world to make those decisions for you. And that's where you get really fucked.
You got it.
I'm just impressed that you were probably, what, around 25 when you got sober?
26, yeah.
Wow. That is earlier than most people realize.
I did a little dude. Come on. Come on. Look, I did not get cheated on the research and development of
did you have a gradual, because I've been sober 12 years and I didn't have like one specific thing that happened where I was like, oh no, I guess I have to. It was just gradual and like, I probably shouldn't do this anymore. Did you have a thing, or was it just a series of choices?
I had a series of incremental choices over a period of a year that even I was like, I do remember carrying in my wallet for the year previous the number of like a drug and alcohol interventionist. I carried it in my wallet.
Oh wow! So somewhere in your brain, you knew I'm going to need this sooner.
So when the day came, I knew exactly what to do. I went to my mom, pulled out the card, and made the call.
Right.
But like, can you imagine for a year carrying that around? I mean, it was, I guess that you're unconscious, or, you know, I don't know what made me do it, but I did. And but no, I didn't really have a overly dramatic moment. It was just, but I, when I was done, I was done. I was truly done. I'd had it. I was over it. I'd sort of been there, done that. And that's the thing I always tell people. And I spend a lot of time now, talking to people about recovery who are interested, and particularly with adolescents and, you know, people who are youngish. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of youngish at 26. And the thing that I think gave me some success was I was ready.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't doing it for my parents. I wasn't doing it to hold onto a job. I wasn't doing it because I was in trouble with the law. I wasn't doing it for anybody other than me. And, you know, until you're doing it for you, you're doomed.
Yeah, it's very difficult because you will still always find a way to go back to that if you're not ready. And it's unfortunate that most people have difficulty realizing, hey, you know, I'm worth it. I'm worth it to make these positive. It's better for me, and I deserve to.
Well, here's what's great. People used to say, you need to work on your self-esteem. And I'd be like, great. What do I – so that sounds good. Well, how do I – no argument here.
Where's the switch?
How do I do that? Like, what do you do? Is it like – can I do push-ups? Can I – like, what is the – what exactly do you do? And I'm telling you, it's taken me, honestly, until 51 years of age to get what that is. And what it is – and nobody ever told me this until somebody very special did tell me – is it's – you – the only way to work on your self-esteem is to do self-esteeming behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're doing anything that isn't esteemful to yourself, that isn't living in integrity, that isn't being completely on all of those things, you're always going to have a problem with your self-esteem.
Sure.
So I know that sounds simple, but I never got it because they throw that around all the time. Well, that guy, he has very low self-esteem. You know what his problem is? No self-esteem. And I'm like, okay, all right, well, how do you – it's like a chicken and the egg
right.
conversation
right.
to me.
That's it's also – it's very demeaning too, because it's almost like saying to someone with a mental illness, don't have a
yes,
mental illness anymore.
That's exactly what
I'm
saying.
Why don't you just not have a mental illness? Like, oh, that'd be great. You think I don't fucking want that?
That's exactly right. And I learned that little thing is like day by day by day making the right choices. And I always like to try to do things my way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my thing is like, I'd like to do some of that. Yeah, I'd like to make some right choices. I'd like to make some wrong choices too. And I'd really like to do that. And unfortunately, you can't.
Right. Well, but I think that's fine. I think it's okay to, you know, people who are sort of questioning, you know, can I exist without being tied to this, you know, this substance or this other thing? And the answer is yes, you can. And it's different, but it's better. And I really came to embrace the concept of having real experiences as opposed to having experiences that were fake or clouded by a substance or conversations that weren't real.
It's just good to remember them.
It's nice to remember things.
I like remembering them when I wake up.
It's nice to remember things. It feels good to take responsibility for stuff, but it sounds like you have something in your DNA that makes you a survivor. Like you seem like you want to survive.
Yes.
Something in you wants to survive.
No, I feel that. I do. I mean, I do. I feel that. I relate to that. That's my thing. Like, that's what I relate to. That's my ethos. That's, you know, my thing. Like, I'm, you know, I read Atlas Shrugged and I'm like, yeah, that's right. Other people read it and go, well, are these people crazy? You know, but I'm the Atlas Shrugged guy.
Yeah. But you also seem to make choices because you've been on a bunch of – you've been on so many different – your IMDb page – it's like you need to – I need to take a break and then like go to the – take a bathroom break and then come back and finish it. But it seems like, you know, you'll work on stuff, and when it seems like it's not fun anymore, you don't work on it anymore.
No, that's – I've been really lucky to be able to sort of call my own shots in that way in terms of when it's time to move on. Because inevitably everything has a creative high point.
Sure.
And then you're just sort of retreading it.
Yeah.
And I find that for me on television in particular, it's usually about at year four.
Mm-hmm.
And that's doing 22 episodes a year.
Right.
My guess is on cable, when you do less episodes, it may be much longer than four seasons. But here's the thing, you know it when you see it. Like when you start reading the scripts that are stuck, you know it as an actor. And I've just been in different positions where I've been able to move on to the next thing.
Which is scary too. I mean, it's like, you know, how do you, you leave a hit show, a show like West Wing, or like, yeah. Wow, well, this show's a hit show. People are watching it, but you know what? I'm not happy here anymore. So I'm going to go do something. I think that is on the surface of it, it seems risky, but in the way that you describe it, it feels like, no, it'd be risky to not do that.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing for that in particular, for me, my kids were at a certain age where they were young enough that I was really trying to teach them the basics of life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is value yourself, right? And you know, for reasons that I go into, I think really well in my book. And it's sort of like when you ask why did somebody divorce, it's very hard to talk
about that. Of course.
In a condensed time frame. But I wasn't being valued there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really couldn't look my kids in the face and talk about being valued if I was eating shit at work every day.
Right.
So I moved on, and it ended up being the greatest thing ever, because it led to great things for me. But, you know, then Aaron left, you know, 5 episodes after I left. And without Aaron Sorkin, there is no West Wing.
Right.
So,
I mean, who writes that snappy dialogue
the thought of being on the West Wing without Aaron Sorkin, that would have been torture.
Sure. And, you know, how many times have you been, though, because when that many shows and people see, like, they see all your successes, you know, a lot of times people don't see how much work you put in and how many things didn't go and how many things close and how many – I mean, you have such a high success rate because you're up to bat a lot. You know what I mean?
Right,
like you're able to – but you're able to weather the stuff that – you know. And so when something doesn't work, even if you wanted it to work – again, how do you just sort of mentally put that aside and keep moving forward?
I know, and that's the thing. I mean, after Parks and Recreation was ending, and we knew it was going to end because we knew what season it was, and you know, so we had time to prepare, all of us, everybody on the show, and I was trying to figure out what the next sort of train leaving the station would be, and you know, I was developing 2 shows. They didn't really. It didn't really work. I wasn't really happy with them, and neither were my partners at the networks. And you know, you just kind of you throw a lot of stuff against the wall and do your best on all of it. And some of it's going to stick, and some of it isn't. And I kind of believe, like, if you work hard for yourself, usually what you're doing may not work, but it will open the door.
Sure.
For something unexpected to come to you, which is what happened with The Grinder, which is my new show.
Yeah, I see the billboards for it with Fred Savage.
Yeah, it's everywhere, and it's so funny.
And he's great, too, by the way.
He's amazing. But I was developing my own, and grinding it out, no pun intended. Those things didn't pan out, and The Grinder showed up on my doorstep out of the blue as if it had been written for me. And I believe it's because I was working so hard and trying to take control of my own destiny and doing the footwork, as they say, that it allowed the universe to present me with something that was even better.
Yeah, you kind of set the table. You had to go through all the stuff that you went through to get, and sometimes it's very hard. It's very hard to, you know, when you're getting kicked in the head to go, no, this will have value at some point.
I know, man.
You know, if someone's in a bad relationship or a bad job or a bad something, and go, you know, I know it doesn't seem like it, but someday, if you are able to take the right lesson out of this, you will be able to use this to your benefit. It'll make you stronger. It'll make you make better choices or something if you're willing to pay attention.
Yeah.
But I think there's also something to be said for people don't work as much as you do if they're dicks, because the business, because the second the business doesn't need you anymore, if you're a dick, you're done.
No, it's unbelievable. And by the way, it says it should be. But no, it's – look, I was always the pleasure to have in class. I literally was.
I feel like I'm reading that on an evaluation that you'd got to – Rob is a pleasure to have in class.
No, I got it. I absolutely did get that. And, you know, I was always like sitting in the front row with my hand up. That's just who I was, and that's who I still am in terms of being a partner with people. I mean, I'm enthusiastic. I'm into it. You know, I'm not afraid to embrace it for fear of looking like a nerd. You know,
yeah.
Like I'm all about it. So, yeah, I do. And I think that is one of the reasons why I'm able to work as much as I do.
But also, I mean, to hear that you struggled with selfies because everyone looks up. I mean, I'm, you know, there's the image of you up on the screen.
Well, you know what I say about that?
What?
Never compare your insides to someone else's outsides.
Oh, that's a good saying.
That's my favorite one.
That's a really good saying.
Yeah, it's really good.
Never compare your insides to someone else's outsides. But I guess that's just, you know, but if you're seeing someone in two dimensions, that's all you have. And especially now, there's so much that people are trying to process because there's so much information being thrown at us at all times that people just make the quick and easy choice. Oh, that person's about that. That dude's about that. That's what that lady's about. Without, because it's so much work and energy to take the time to really get to know someone.
Who has the time? And one of the things one of the reasons I wrote my first book, Stories I Only Tell My Friends, and the second book, Love Life, was that if people read them, and I didn't know if they would or they wouldn't, that they would really truly know who I am. And because you can't really get it. I mean, this is great to do something like this because this is fairly in depth. There's not a producer counting us down and we can talk about whatever we want to talk about. And this is great.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
It's like great. But that's rare to be able to do that. And so people make snap judgments about me and 9 times out of 10, they get it wrong.
Sure.
Because the way I look, they go, oh, well, if he looks like that, he's got to be this. But, and by the way, I'm not taking it personally. I think we all do that. We all look at something. And by the way, we have to judge things visually. We have to at least put that into the equation.
Yes. But unfortunately, a lot of times that's the only equation that we use. And it's very, very difficult. And a lot of times it's people who are saying, I don't want to be judged. I don't want to be judged. But that guy's a piece of shit. And you're like,
Right.
I mean, I mean, when I was growing up, it was like, you know, like me and five other nerd kids who were in chess club and in the computer lab and, you know, so adamantly upset that everyone else judged us for the shit that we were into, but then also reciprocally judging, and so whenever I see anyone that kind of looked like those, like, oh yeah, but that guy's a dick, you know?
Yeah, that's
like,
funny.
You don't
know
that. I mean, like, if we really had the time, you know, it's so wonderful to be able to sit down and talk to people on a human level. And I think you would find that most people everyone has a story.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not you can get it out of them is one thing. But, it's one of the reasons why I love having done 750 episodes of this show is just being able to sit down with people like you. And wow, I didn't really know that. And it's like, you know, well, they're a human being with feelings and dreams and insecurities and hopes. And how did they get past
that? But that's
why
what you do is really, truly like an important thing. And to be able to love listening to your podcast and listening to.
Oh, thank
to
you.
To hear people who I love and get to see them in a different light is awesome. But here's the good thing. I've been around now long enough that I don't know if it's. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. Length of time in the zeitgeist, mm-hmm. some of the projects that I've chosen to do, the books, and that for the first time, really, I feel known.
Yep.
I feel seen, heard, understood, known, really.
For real. Like,
for real.
Like with actual depth.
For real.
Yeah.
Like when I walk down the street and somebody says, hey, rah, I feel like it's like they actually do get what I'm about.
Right.
The first time ever. And it started about three or four years ago.
That's so funny that it took that far into your career. And it's also one of the things that makes me not, you know, I guess, you know, within the last few years, of course, I was just freaking out about getting older and, you know, like I'll be 44 this year and, you
know. It's all good, man. It only gets better.
And honestly, people that I talk to that are in their 50s and say like, you know, I've never felt more okay than I feel now, and I wouldn't trade all the shit that I went through just so that I could have this moment, you know, and just feel like okay, like feel good and wise and happy. And
that's the way I 47 is when it started for me. I remember it now. I don't know what it was about that number, but when I turned 47, I just felt like I was finally getting into, you know, my comfort zone.
Which is what? What do you think your comfort zone is?
I mean, if, you know, fulfillment, happiness on every level, where I was in my marriage, where I was with my kids, where they were in their lives, where I was with my career, where I was in terms of how people were embracing what I was doing, mm-hmm. all of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also probably hard when you're in it too and you don't really see. But I just,
for so many years, I've always had the perception of, like, you know, especially since Wayne's World, like, oh yeah, he's a good guy. Like good guys make choices like that. Like, he's just a good guy.
Well, see, I'm glad you get that, because that's sort of the way I perceive it. Because if the shoe were on the other foot, if I saw another act, like, I watch other actors and I see some of their choices and I go, that guy's a genius. That's so awesome that they're doing that. And yet there's some people like, oh, he's the dick from Wayne's World. That guy's a dick. That's out there. Believe me, there are people that go. Right? And we're getting nods.
Yeah, because, yes, of course, there are people who see movies and think that everything's a documentary and you're the character that you play.
It's actually a surprising number.
It doesn't matter how.
It is. And the reason I know it is because, you know, I'm very active on my Twitter feed, and people are like, I always thought you were the dick from Wayne's. I'm like, I was playing a character.
Yeah, it was a,
and
you
it
know,
was the fact that I chose to do it was the dog whistle that I'm not a dick.
You know, Mike Myers didn't really do a public access show in a basement. Right, that was just part of the, like, yeah, it's so funny that they accept that.
People honestly say to me, I've always hated you since Tommy Boy.
You're like, you know, so it was okay for everyone else to get big comic characters in that movie, but I'm the one who's the actual dick?
I'm telling you, it's unbelievable.
Now, with that movie, I'm sure with both of them, you must have felt while you were doing it that there was something special happening. Because you don't always know, but did you feel it at that time?
Tommy Boy is one of those ones where I actually did not know. Wayne's World, I knew. Wayne's World, I definitely knew we were doing something funny and fun and could break out. I never thought it would be as big as it was. But Tommy Boy, I just thought we were making another movie. I didn't know how well it would turn out. I didn't know how much heart it would have. It has so much heart, which I think is the key to it.
Yeah.
And which is why people still really do love that movie.
Yeah.
And of course, there was no way of knowing that, you know, it would be the high watermark for Chris Farley.
Right.
You know, so who people still love. And, I look back really fondly on that one. But people do think I'm a dick because I was in it.
but even the DirecTV commercials, I was like, yeah, this guy knows how to make fun of it. Like, you wouldn't do that if you didn't have that thing in you that had some awareness and you were able to play with it.
Yeah, that's exactly what goes into it. You know, it's funny, people. Here's what I learned about comedy. What's really weird is that even when people like it, very few people can articulate why they like it.
Sure.
Right? So what I've learned is if people say they think I'm funny, I should stop the conversation right there.
I gotta go. Because thank you. Bye. Gotta go.
Because the minute they tell me why they think I'm funny, they're going to say something that makes me really depressed.
Like what?
Like the phrase, he doesn't take himself seriously, or he pokes fun at himself, right? Which I get why people say it,
right?
And I don't look. I'm not pretentious. I don't like people who are. I'm not self-serious.
Yeah.
But the jump of not taking yourself seriously,
right?
If I didn't take myself seriously, I'd still be getting loaded.
Of course.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I 100% understand what you mean.
If I didn't take myself seriously, I wouldn't be investing as much as I did in raising my family. I mean, I take myself really seriously. So do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, they've misplaced what the definition of self is.
They've misplaced – that phrase is misused. We need a better phrase. There are actors out there who don't take themselves seriously, and they hack it up, and they do whatever's asked of them. And they're big ham bones.
Yeah.
And they'll wear a fucking clown hat and do anything for a laugh. Those are actors who don't take themselves seriously.
Right.
I think what we're talking about is the ability to do somebody who's self-aware and to do parody and satire. This is, by the way, we've gone way into the weeds in this, but it is a little thing that drives me a little
bit
crazy.
Well, it is. You know, I think when they say to take yourself seriously, it's like this character that they see, that your work, that you're willing to, you know, play with the archetype of what they think. Because
I'm down. I'm totally down for that description.
Because it is kind of weird. Like being as an attractive person as you are is actually can be detrimental in some ways, particularly with comedy, because I think people if they feel threatened in any way, the walls go up.
Right.
You know what I mean? And if they see a guy who's more attractive than they are, oh, well, what the fuck kind of problems is that guy possibly? You know, because they can't imagine that you're a human being with feelings and thoughts and
right,
depth
right, no,
and,
right, right,
and,
right.
And cracks and, you know. So it was like, oh, you know, because they – because we as an audience feel insecure about ourselves. And so it's – I think – you know, I wouldn't take that as personal because I feel like that's more of a statement about where – the person is coming from in their life than anything that has to do with you, because obviously they don't know.
No, it's really true, and it, you know, I'm getting it's a current thing on my mind because of the way the good news is of the way the Grindr is being received, and I'm playing a character that one could see as being similar to me. He's a narcissistic, self-centered giant television star, and I definitely have that somewhere in me, but it's not a documentary.
Not a documentary.
How do you know?
It's pretend.
And people are digging it, so I'm there's a lot of talk of like where does the truth begin, and you know, and where is it?
But you just you know, but I think people do understand at this point. I think you have more than proven, like you couldn't hang in Wayne's World and you couldn't hang on Tommy Boy and you wouldn't be able to hang in a show like Parks and Rec with some of the best improvisers in the world if you didn't deserve it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, no, thank
you. Maybe you would get one shot, but it would never happen again. But it wouldn't be thing after thing after thing. Like, people wouldn't keep putting you in that position if you couldn't hang.
No, I've been
and I think
so,
people understand that.
Oh, now listen, I've been so lucky that comedy is such a cyclical young man's business, it seems to me. And at every sort of generation, I've been so blessed to be embraced by people. I mean, it was Lorne first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's one of the people that defies it being a young man's business. And then it was Mike and Dana. And then it was Chris and Spade. And then it was Ricky Gervais. And then it was, you know, Amy Poehler. And it just keeps sort of moving forward, and it's fun to be sort of, you know, a part of each wave that comes up.
I mean, honestly, you know, it's not an accident that you work with that many comedically genius people. I mean, I think if you sort of look at the data points by proxy, it's sort of like, oh, wait a minute, did you see any consistency with all of them? Like, now that you sort of look back, you go, oh, for, you know, for someone who's a comedy genius, there must be a this or this or this. Like, what's the through line with all
the
those
The through
people?
Line is wickedly smart. Wickedly smart. I've never met anybody who was funny who wasn't brilliant. I've never met a stupid person that was smart, ever. So there's that.
Yeah.
And tremendous work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other. What was it? Smart, work ethic. Oh, and fearless.
Yeah.
Fearless. Do not. Will do anything. Chris Farley was, I mean, the stuff he would do for a laugh, he was, I mean, there's no vanity in comedy. It's like when here's my barometer. If I pitch something to my wife that I think is funny and she doesn't laugh, I do it. Because her whole thing, and it's why I love her, is she never wants me to look bad.
Right. Oh, it's so genius that you're able to recognize that.
Right.
That's your, I'm gonna aim for wind.
Yeah, no, she, and you know, she's petrified of her beloved husband looking like a fool or looking like an idiot or looking like an idiot, and you can't live there and survive in comedy. So if it makes her nervous, I know that I'm in the right place.
Well, I mean, you know, look, just so you know, and obviously this is going to sound very kiss-uppy because you're here, but it's just an observation. But everything that you described about those other people, I mean, you were describing yourself at the same time.
Wow,
I mean, like, you know, you again, you can't be in the proximity of that without being, you know what I mean? Like, maybe once, but not, you know, for 25 years without having that too. Those people just – they're – a lot of comics are just too narcissistic. They wouldn't put their necks out for you if they didn't feel like you could hang with them. You know what I mean?
No, so thank you.
It's kind of a – I hope when you look back at your career that you understand that it's like – you're not just supporting these other funny people. Like, you're with them, you know? Like, you're a co-conspirator.
Oh, thank you. That's an honor to think about with that group. And I mean, even that Parks and Rec cast, when you – jeez, I mean, when you look back and think of who was on that show already, and it's only, I mean, it, by the way, it's nominated for an Emmy this weekend.
Yeah.
Our little show, our little canceled show is nominated for an Emmy, and but you look back and go, God, we could never get those people back on television again.
Right. It was just the right time for all of, to pull all of them together.
Yeah.
And then everyone blew up.
Blew up. So,
Aziz is playing like multiple shows at Madison Square Garden.
It's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Aziz.
I know.
He's the guy who asked for, you know, where to get the best Indian food from.
Oh, and now best, like, any food.
Best any food.
That guy, if you're in any city and you have Aziz Ansari's phone number, you should text him and go, I'm in Dubuque. Where is the best Ethiopian food? And he'll tell you.
He's such an amazing foodie. He's unreal.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But it just seems like a good, you know, and I think that's the other thing. At a certain point is realizing, like, you know, the business is hard enough. We don't have to make it harder by creating drama. It's fun that we get – it's silly that we get to do this shit that right. we get to do. It's so – it's almost dumb that we get to go play. We go get to play. So how do we – you know, how do we keep it as fun – how do we keep it as fun as possible?
It, you know, that starts with the leadership on each show.
Yeah.
Because I've been on shows where it's deadly, deadly, deadly. And, like, you feel like – everybody thinks they're curing cancer.
Right.
And really. And it's like, oy. And then it starts with the people at the top, the executive producers, if it's television, and whoever's number one on the call sheet.
Yeah.
And you know, you just, it's like anything else. It's who are your bosses.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a reminder that television and, dare I even say, film are not the most important things in the world. They're
no
fun.
Kidding. No
they're,
kidding.
They're supposed to be entertaining, but they're not the most important things in the world.
No, and look, I'm struggling with it because my youngest son is very. Both my sons are amazingly smart. My oldest is going to law school next year, and my youngest was the youngest published stem cell researcher.
Jesus.
In the country, and he's up at Stanford, and now he's thinking maybe he wants to be an actor. And you know,
you gotta let him know.
Here's the thing: it's like, yeah, sure. The world doesn't need any more smart people. It needs more people wearing makeup for a living. That's what the world is screaming out for.
I didn't put on makeup for 40 years so that you could put on makeup.
That's exactly
go it. Make stem cells.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable.
But you know, I think, you know what I think is kind of cool about that though is, you know, if he tries it, he tries it, you know, and then if it speaks to him, he'll pursue it, and yep. if not, then he won't. And you know, like, stem cell research is not a bad fallback. And also, I think it gives depth too. It gives depth. Like, I always love hearing about, you know, sometimes we'll have people on who are musicians, and you've like the guy from Dexter Holland from The Offspring came on the podcast. I didn't know what to expect until I did a bunch of backstory on him, and he's a scientist who's involved with AIDS research.
See, that's
and yeah. so and then you go, oh wow, and how much depth? Like, here's a guy who was making one kind of thing, and then you find out this whole other thing about him, and he's actually helping him, and it just makes you. It just makes you love people even more when you find out they're multidimensional.
Yeah, that is true. I'll remember that as he puts his makeup on.
If he even gets it, you know, you have to prepare him for the audition process is probably harder than stem cell research.
No, by the way, it is true. I was like, okay, we'll see how you like it when they say, nah, you know, or whatever.
Sorry, you're an inch too short. What? Yeah. But I did a good reading. That doesn't really, that's secondary.
Yep,
you know, it's nice. It's nice that you can do that. Do you ever have to audition for anything anymore?
I'm trying to think. I mean, I actually like auditioning.
You do? Why?
I do. I like it. Because I feel like pound for pound, let me at them.
Yeah.
I figure like, do you know what I mean? I'm like, yeah, no, let's bring in, you know, whoever else and let's test and compare. So I like that stuff. That said, it's pretty rare. I mean, I can't even think of the last time I did it. But I would do it, and I'm asked to do it. There's definitely certain things you're still asked to do.
Oh, that's good though. That, you know, that what's nice about that is it makes it feel like it's about the work. Because I certainly envision, you know, I think it would be easy to be like, oh, I don't have to do that anymore. Great, done. I'll just go right to the set. I don't care. I don't need to, you know, go in front of a room and have a bunch of stone-faced people judge me while I try to tap dance for them.
Yeah, I mean, on the other side of it, though, is this, is the when you have been around as long as I have been, it's like you kind of know what I can do, right?
Right.
So there's a little bit of like, really?
Yeah.
So do you think I can be funny? Well, you can look at this, this, and this. So you think you can do dialogue? You can look at West Wing or whatever it is. So it's out there to be done, yeah. But I'm still willing to come in and do it because I just enjoy it. And I like – I had to read for the West Wing. I mean, I auditioned for that. And everybody, I think, who works for Aaron has to audition because it's a very specific skill set to
do.
Oh,
my God. What a stressful audition that must have been with just like two-page monologues
brutal.
And like crazy and I'm sure you have to stick every – It has to be – you can't really riff, I would imagine, because it has to be done exactly the way that he makes it.
Exactly the way he makes it, and it's one of those things that if – it's sort of like a gymnast when they do the dismount. Like if it has to be – if you fuck it up at all, it's over.
Yeah.
And it has to look effortless and easy. And that was a highlight, that audition. I mean, it was really fun. I love it. I love doing that. I mean, I'm – But then again, you get the weird call out of the blue, like from Steven Soderbergh, who I'd never met, huge fan, and he calls out of the blue and says, you know, do this Liberace movie. I don't know why he thought of me. I don't know. My agent said, hey, there's a little worth talking about Steven Soderbergh. Nothing. It was out of the blue. And, you know, Behind the Candelabra ends up being a really fun thing for me.
Well, yeah. And then also, you know, that's where you really need – I imagine you really need someone like Steven Soderbergh when the movie is going so kind of big in one direction. You have to be able to trust the guy. Okay, you're going to be able to – this is all going to make sense, you know? Like when you were shooting it, did it feel like a giant stage play? What did it feel like?
Well, he's such a genius. There's a lot of talk people say about, well, the director cuts in his head, as they say, which basically means he only shoots exactly what is going to be on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And my very first day, I did a scene with Michael as Liberace that where we meet at a doorway and hug and kiss, and he invites me in. And we shot my side of it. And then as we're about to turn around to do Michael's, I assumed, Stephen goes, okay, that's it. Next scene. He didn't even shoot Michael.
Oh, wow.
Didn't even shoot him. Because he knew what he wanted in the movie was the door opening, my crazy looking face, and Michael saying, come in, and then we cut to the next scene. Any other director on the planet shoots Michael and has other options, but not Steven. He knows what he wants, and he moves quick. It was really amazing.
Oh, yeah. That's incredible. I think some people might be forced to do that for budgetary reasons, but certainly not at the Steven Soderbergh level where you could shoot a shit ton of stuff.
Well, and how about this? How about not shooting your star?
Oh, yeah.
Hell no, Michael. We don't need you. Rob Lowe just came in for a couple days. Yeah, he's the only guy we need. Great. We're moving on.
So no Liberace in this one?
No Liberace? Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, good.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, good. Cut it. Print. Actually, anybody, if you just watch Liberace, you're like, I don't think Michael Douglas was actually in that at all. He just cut him around him the entire time. It was just everyone else reacting to Liberace.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fun to – have you ever thought about have you done a lot of like old Western type stuff?
I would love to.
Because I think you'd be great in like a Tombstone.
Oh,
like a
bring it on, man.
Would you be like a Wyatt Earp or like a Doc Holliday? Like,
well, Val as Doc Holliday in that movie is one of my favorite performances ever.
I mean, I can't imagine the first day on set he started doing that. Well, I'm your Huckleberry, and everyone going, "What the fuck is he doing?" And then you see it, and you're like,
"Oh yeah." You know, when you talk about – listen, so here's the thing. If you have a Western out there, I'm your man. but here's what I've always wanted to be. I've always wanted to be in the Disney screening room the day they see the very first rushes of Johnny Depp doing that pirate.
Oh, yeah.
Because what they want is Jake Gyllenhaal and the Prince of Persia.
Right.
That's what they want.
Right. They don't want Keith Richards. They don't know they want Keith Richards.
And what they get is that. I mean, and I honestly believe that's the greatest acting choice of my lifetime. I really do.
Oh, Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow?
Without a doubt. I mean, it's easy to look back on it now and go, yeah, no, it was great. He's brilliant in it. But you have to understand what was at stake. This is a billion-dollar franchise, this and that, and they want hot Johnny, hottie hot man.
Yeah.
As the swashbuckling pirate.
Right.
And he gives them that.
When everyone else is playing it totally straight, and then he comes on, hello, what is it?
No, I mean, honestly, it's like that is And you know what? Guess what? The lesson is the rest is history.
Well, yes, because he's certainly another guy who was probably in a very similar situation to you, who was like, oh, people see me as this. So the way that I'm going to show them who I am is to do this other thing.
Which we get, and that's all great. That's great if he's like in some Sundance indie movie. This is like Disney, Jerry Bruckheimer, Bob Iger. Do you know what I mean? That takes a lot of balls.
Well, he was very fortunate that he was at a point in his career where he could call that shot and not have someone go, because who's going to tell him at that point not to do that?
Well, and I also think just knowing what little I know of Johnny, who is hilarious, he's like, okay, let's get real. I'm doing a movie about an amusement park ride.
Right.
If I'm going down, I'm going down swinging.
As hard as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they'd tried a couple others. There was a Haunted Mansion movie.
There was a Haunted Mansion movie.
Yeah.
That was what he was following up.
Yeah. So
so I get the calculus. I so know what the calculus was, but still, it's ballsy to do it.
Have you been to Disneyland lately?
I haven't. Oh my god! What is it now? Is it Pirates of the Caribbean now all Johnny?
They've woven him in,
right?
They've woven him in, and they've woven Davy Jones in a little bit. It's still basically the same
good
ride, but there's just little pieces here and there where you can see the animatronics are a little updated, and he's hiding in a couple places. And at the very end, and what can I can only imagine he must have been paid an exorbitant amount of money to come in for 30 seconds. But when you're finishing the ride and you're going up the incline, it's him in a cave of treasure just rocking back and forth like, yo-ho, drink up your hearties, yo-ho. Like, he says like three things that sound so like, we got it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. My favorite is Harrison Ford in the Indiana Jones ride. As many times as I've been to Disney, I defy any listener, if you can tell me what exactly he's saying.
It's all right, kid.
I've tried... Every time I go to Disneyland, all I'm interested in is that this will be the time where I'm going to figure out what the fuck Harrison Ford is saying.
You kind of hope the ride breaks down at that point. So yeah. But it's something to the effect of like, all I've ever heard is, hey, kid, you're all right with that. Like, there's no, I know kid, I can hear kid.
I don't know what happened.
Don't talk to me.
And then I wonder, maybe it isn't Harrison.
I don't
maybe
think it is.
Maybe that's why...
I don't think it is.
Sound alike?
I think it's I think they would have nailed the face a little bit more. I think they've done an approximation of Harrison Ford, and I don't think it's the actual. I don't think it's the actual voice.
I'm a little bit obsessed with it.
Yeah, I think it's a. I think he. I don't know. I don't know anything about him personally. I think he really turned a corner after he landed a plane on the golf course.
Right.
Because at Comic-Con in previous times, he was crotchety. And at Comic-Con this year, he was very gracious and got choked up and was very excited to be there for Star Wars. And
that's
I think
awesome.
He had some sort of – so I can't imagine in the old days of him coming in and doing all the voices for the Indiana Jones
ride. That's not a call you want to make as an agent.
What? Why the fuck would I do that?
Why the fuck would I do that?
But now I'd be like, oh, please, let me...
It's my legacy.
Do you want
I'm
me to stand
to
there? I'm
it.
Happy to
it's
stand
the
there
children.
At the end of the ride, you know, for the kids.
Yeah.
But the Grindr is... do you want to... What time? What's the information?
Grindr is on Fox starting on the 29th at 8:30. So it's Tuesdays at 8:30.
Tuesdays at 8:30.
And I have to say, it is really... It's a very odd and in a great way... I'm shocked it's on network television, honestly. It's just a really great world and truly laugh out loud funny. Each script I get, I laugh out loud.
Well, thank you so much for being so open and for also not just making fun comedy choices and being in a lot of things that were influential to us, but also just being a good person and help and showing people that they can make their lives better if they make positive choices.
Yeah.
If they just had self-esteem, if they could just...
How do I do it again? What
just
do I
do? It. You
is
just
it like push-ups?
It's a couple of push-ups, I think. It's like 3 to 5 push-ups.
Yeah, it's like getting your oil checked.
In
you
the
just
morning.
Gotta go in and do
you
it.
You just gotta go in and do it. Come on, guys.
That's right.
And also ask good questions and make healthy choices and give a shit about yourself.
Right.
And those would be nice to people around you.
Right.
And make choices that are good for you. Yeah. Thank you, Rob Lowe.
Thank you. This was amazing. We'll do it again.
Oh, I would love to. Please come
back.
Yeah,
no, we have to. This is great.
Please, please. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
For sure.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.